I'm Sandy Klein. Welcome to the 51%, Conversations with Creative Women. Leonora Wiener has been around. This longtime New Yorker is currently the Director of Content Strategy at the Ford Foundation, one of the world's largest philanthropic organizations. It's been on the front lines of global social change for the past 77 years. Before joining that prestigious organization, Leonora was executive editor at InStyle magazine, often referred to as the fashion Bible. She was an executive editor at Parenting magazine and supervising editor at Scholastic. Leonora was the vice president of product development at BigChalk.com, an online educational company whose customer base included 40,000 K-12 schools. Before that, she worked in the public sector as Director of Communications, Office of Public Information at the Administration for Children's Services, New York City's child welfare agency, which has certainly received its share of media attention. Leonora, glad you were able to stop by.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So, the Ford Foundation. Whoa. Explain to the uninitiated the role of the Director of Content Strategy.
I oversee all of our digital and print and multimedia content. We as an organization, as you said, are working on the front lines of social change. And what we try to do is produce compelling content that helps move social change forward.
So what? Give me an example of a project that you just are recently working on or have been working on, something that you considered huge.
This past fall, the foundation launched an initiative around LGBT rights. And we wanted to bring all the different groups together who are working on LGBT rights and not only announce our funding, but let people, you know, there are some people that might focus just on marriage equality. There are people that might just focus on teens. We wanted to get them all together to talk about what's the phase two. Well, maybe phase two isn't the right word. What's the next front lines for LGBT?
So for around the world?
Well, we're focused right now in the U.S., but yes, we will be having a global portfolio. And what we wanted to do with the media that we created was give voice to the many people in the LGBT community who don't always have a seat at the table. So we produced a fantastic video. My multimedia producer made it, and it's just a very compelling look at all the different issues that affect the LGBT community, from whether you are a teen and kicked out of your house, whether you are an elderly couple who can't visit each other in a nursing home, all of the issues from birth to death that affect the LGBT communities. And I felt that the multimedia we produced, the staging we produced, the print materials we produced all worked really in harmony to bring that message to our conference and our event.
Is it a group effort when a project is born, you know, as in, you know, focusing on LGBT? Where does that come from?
Absolutely. It is completely a collaborative effort. And that's what I feel proudest of, is being able to bring people together on a creative project and make it work. So we start with the grant makers, the people who are going to be funding this initiative. And we say, what are you going to be doing? How are you going to be approaching this social change issue? And working with them, then we figure out, okay, this is how we want to create content around your issue. So it's very, very collaborative. And then we have a multimedia producer, we have a web producer, print person. So everyone works very much together.
So it's funny, and I guess I'm showing either my ignorance or naivete. The Ford Foundation just doesn't tackle hunger and disenfranchised children in Africa. You know, I wouldn't have thought of your organization, and I wouldn't have said Ford Foundation and LGBT in the same sentence.
We work on a wide variety of issues, and we have 8 issue areas that we focus on, and it ranges from LGBT to sustainable development. And what unifies all of those issues is we really believe people deserve the chance to live in dignity. We come to it from a social justice perspective. We want to change the systems and the structures that prevent people from living their full potential. And so that's true whether it is LGBT or whether it's women's rights or whether it's human rights. It all is connected by that.
Are you surprised you're at the Ford Foundation based on your professional past? Or is this, on some level, the next logical step? Was this the next logical step for you?
It was the next logical step for me personally. If someone were to look at my resume, they would say they wouldn't connect those dots.
I agree.
But, you know, it's funny. Ever since I started out professionally, when I was started out in magazines, and I loved working in magazines. But after about 6 or 7 years of that, I knew that I didn't want to turn 65 or 70 and look back and say, I did one thing.
Mm-hmm.
I knew I wanted to try different sectors or different places of work. And, you know, sometimes I questioned that choice, but it was kind of in me from the start. So in terms of how I wound up at the Ford Foundation, I had worked in more, I'd worked for Children's Services, as you mentioned.
Yeah, we're going to get into that.
And I'd worked for educational publishing. So there's always been a part of me that is concerned about mission-driven mm-hmm. organizations. But I also love the guilty pleasures of magazines, of fashion magazines and celebrity magazines. So, you know, I guess we're all a little schizophrenic that way.
That's a great way to put it. I think that's a good point, because I was going to ask you about the contrast of InStyle with the Ford Foundation. Describe the life of a person who works at such a premier magazine. Did you love it? Was it stressful? Oh, how's that for such a stupid question? But, I mean, why'd you leave?
Well, I did love it. I did love it. And part of my job there was I was the international editor. So I went around the world to different countries to help them set up InStyle. And what the unifying thread between InStyle and the Ford Foundation, and there is one, is that in both of those situations, I was leading creative teams to create products or services.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, whether it was working in China to get these young women journalists, you know, and at the time that we started InStyle China, which is no longer being published, they didn't have a long tradition of consumer trade magazines that they were producing around fashion and celebrity. So it was really like giving them a journalism course.
Wow.
Or a magazine journalism course. And watching that team, the writers and the editors and the art directors and the photographers coalesce and come together to produce this monthly magazine was really gratifying.
But, I mean, that's mind-boggling to me that China had nothing, right, to compare on any level to an InStyle, right? So you're really giving birth to something pretty huge, even though they're a very fashion-conscious, hip, successful Chinese men and women in the major cities. But that's mind-boggling.
It was great. You know, a couple of other fashion magazines had already been there.
Okay.
Elle had been there. Vogue had been there. But it was still a nascent industry. And it was very exciting. It was a very exciting time to be working with these young journalists and producing something that they felt really proud of.
So what other places around the world have InStyle magazines?
Well, believe it or not, Romania.
Romania. Okay. Fashion forward Romania.
Yes,
or is that being unfair?
At the time that I was there, there were 17 international editions. And the publishing world has kind of imploded. And that's happened around the world, too. So I'm not sure that they have quite that many editions right now.
When it comes to fashion, what about women of a certain age? Are they disenfranchised regardless of where the print industry stands? I mean, InStyle magazine is not talking to me, is it? They don't expect me to buy
the
December issue, do they?
They might not expect you to buy it. I mean, I'm sure they do hope you to buy it for circulation. But and I would always say this to people, and they thought I was just being completely, only shilling for InStyle. But I feel of all the fashion magazines, InStyle is the kindest to women. You know, InStyle really believes that anyone can have style, that you are not born with it, that it's much gentler to both age and body type. And so in answer to your question, they often have features where they say 50 and up or 40 and up. And I think that they – what's nice about InStyle is they have this sense that daughters and sisters and mothers might all share it and might get inspiration from it.
There are not thousands of pictures of the Kardashians in InStyle?
There are not. There are not. There are a lot, there are some. There's – you know, they are in our celebrity world. But there are many different celebrities in InStyle.
You said that, you know, that the publishing world is imploding, but they are selling actual hard copies of these magazines, right? I mean, this is not something that's going to die off tomorrow, right?
I agree. I agree with you. I think there's something very fulfilling and tactile about magazines, but I think it is going to be greatly reduced. And the publishing world's trying to figure out, well, what's the right combination? Where, you know, how much is digital? How much is print? How much is television? Everyone's trying to figure it out. I don't think anyone's unlocked that yet.
Before you left, were you very involved digitally in the magazine?
I personally wasn't super involved, but yes, there was a very robust website, and they were just starting to at that point, Time Inc. was kind of leading the charge on the tablet publications.
Mm-hmm, sure.
So yeah, they were going down that road when I left.
Did you ever feel that I'm in over my head?
That's a good question. Often the publishers would ask me to go on sales calls with them in Romania or in China because this was a new product. And you know, I'm not from the ad world.
Mm-hmm.
And even though I know a lot about circulation and I know a lot about advertising, I wasn't a salesperson. So in those cases, I would sometimes feel over my head. What was interesting about being the working as the international editor is that when you're overseas, you are the only person they have contact with. So they think you're everything. They think you're a photo stylist and an editor and an ad salesperson.
So they're coming to you with just legions of questions.
Yes, yes. So I did, you know, I was there in a Beijing photo studio styling watches at one point because they didn't know how to do it, and I was the only representative, and I would be emailing our fashion director saying, well, what do you think we should do about this? So I learned a tremendous amount about every aspect of magazine production and styling and all of that.
When you started with InStyle, did you know you were going to be going abroad? That
no.
You were going to run this operation?
I did not. The editor-in-chief at that point asked me to, and at first I said, oh, I'm not sure if I want to do this, even though I've always had a love of travel.
Right.
But I wasn't sure I wanted to do it because I felt like it might marginalize me away from the main magazine. And then when I started doing it, and I loved it.
Did you do much writing in the world of publishing, or it was more editing? How did you get in the door in publishing in general?
Well, this is a great story. I think it's a great story. I was fresh out of college, and I was trying to figure out what am I going to do with myself. And I had majored in history, so I had a basic liberal arts degree. And I started working for a dance company because I was a dancer at that time, and just as an administrative person. And then I started interning at a magazine. And the managing editor left, and I had been her intern. And I had learned all of her work and her contacts and everything. So she left pretty suddenly. So I went into the editor, and I said, I know this is crazy, but, you know, the managing editor left, and I actually know what she does. So I think you should give me her job.
That's great.
And he said, well, you're an intern. I can't call you managing editor. He said, come back to me with a title that's suitable, and I'll consider it. So I went home, and I said to my then boyfriend, I said, I don't know. What should I call myself? And I said, I'll call myself editorial manager. So I walked in the next day and I said, how about editorial manager? I said, you have nothing to lose. Try me for 3 months. If it doesn't work out, you're no worse than you were yesterday when she walked out.
And so you wrote your own ticket.
I did.
So you went from no salary.
Yeah. To a really good position.
That's amazing. And how long were you interning before she decided to leave?
About 6 months.
That's nuts.
Yeah.
And so did that really kind of turned you on to the field, huh?
It did.
Well, why wouldn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, you feel like you're kind of on top of the world for something like that.
Yeah.
So here you are in some very impressive positions that you got all on your own. Do you sort of step back and look and say, what I did? I'm not saying that you look in the mirror and sing something from How to Succeed, but the fact is the progression, and I'm sure there have been some down times too, but it's really impressive. And I think speaks a lot to young women. Not that, oh, you can do anything that you want, but I mean, look at that nerve of going in and saying, hire me, that some might say, and I can take over this woman's job. Is it that you projected a certain amount of confidence, or you really believed in yourself? Nobody else was pushing for you? Talk to me a little bit about that.
You know, honestly, people often say, wow, look at your career. You've done so much. And I don't know if it's
don't tell me the right place at the right time.
No. But I wasn't pushy. I don't feel like I was overly ambitious.
Okay.
I was overly committed. That's, I think, what drove me. And
you were never looking necessarily at the next step. Well, you got to, you know, point A and you said, this is really great, right? And
exactly. Exactly. And I think that because I wasn't sharp-elbowed, because I was genuine, I think that's what has helped my success. You know, when I work with people, both people who work with me and my bosses, I'm extremely loyal. I have people's backs, and I think that genuine loyalty really comes through. And so when I'm moving on to the next thing, I think people really respond to that.
How did you respond to working for the Administration for Children's Services? And for those not in the know, this is a city agency that spends a lot of time in the glare of the media, under the spotlight. A lot has gone wrong. There have been several attempts to turn this agency around. So explain your role. Explain why you think so many things have fallen through the cracks, or maybe that's not fair.
ACS was both the most thrilling job and the most stressful job I've ever had. As the director of communications, I was the press secretary. I was on call 24/7. I think for 2 years I did not go to a movie without sitting in the very last row on the aisle.
I mean, you were the go-to person,
I was
right?
The go-to person. So I went to work for ACS for one reason, Nick Scapetta. Nick Scapetta was the commissioner. He was there to reform the system. He's an amazing leader and a very special person. And I knew that if anyone could accomplish reforms, he would be it. It's at that time, there were 40,000 kids in foster care.
Oh, my God. And what is that time?
What is it? Late 90s?
Was that at its worst? It had
peaked right before then. And it was as a result of the crack epidemic. Decades before, but all those kids were in foster care. And then it started to slowly wane.
Mm-hmm.
So it really was kind of the height. And it's a very hard system. It's a very hard system. And, you know, children are put at risk at very early ages. What is sort of a little known fact about the child welfare system is everyone thinks it's about abuse. It's more about neglect. You know, 80% of the cases are about neglect. They're not about serious physical
and sexual. Locking a child in a closet and not feeding him or her for
right.
6
those are
days.
Those are the media cases, and
right.
there are a lot
the
of them.
The sexy ones.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a lot more low-level neglect that goes on that's extremely damaging for children.
And how do you solve that? Do you have enough caseworkers for 40,000 children? I mean, that number is astonishing. That's a city in and of itself.
Exactly. And the caseload for the child protective workers was impossible, just impossible. And one of the things that Nick did was really focus on reducing that caseload to a manageable size. You know what Jeffrey Canada is doing up in the Harlem Children's Zone, where you have sort of total wraparound, complete services, is one answer. You know, where it's not just one type of service and it's not just one kind of agency, where there's a community responsibility for children. It has to be collaborative with families. It can't be adversarial.
Did you take that job personally?
I did. And at a certain point, when I first got the job, one of the Daily News reporters said to me, "Leonora, you're only going to last in this job 2 years." And I said, "You don't know me. I'm going to be fine. I'm going to be able to do this." And at about the 2-year mark, I had to tell him, "You're right." The stress level, hearing about all these kids, meeting the kids, seeing how hard and demoralizing for the caseworkers it was, it's just a very tough job.
Why were there never any success stories coming out of ACS or that got the spotlight, got into the spotlight?
It's a good question. We did have some success stories, and one of the biggest were the amount of children that found permanent placements through adoption. And a lot of those adoptions were with family. But, you know, it takes a lot of effort and bureaucracy and this and that to make all those adoptions happen. And so once a year we would have a big adoption campaign and affair and all of this. And I would say to the reporters, "Okay, you've been rightfully bullying me all year. When we do adoption, I need you to come out and do some positive stories." And they always did.
So that was one of your tasks, was to turn around the agency's negative public image. I can't imagine a better analogy than Sisyphus pushing a boulder up a mountain. People who don't live in urban areas, this may be hard for them to understand, but in a city like Manhattan with five boroughs and, oh, my God. I mean, how did you turn around? I mean, and nobody, again, who wants to talk about good news, in the media? But, I mean, that had to be a monumental task.
It was. And one of the things that we did, and I had the full support of the commissioner, was we did a new branding for the agency to be focused on the positive services that we were delivering to families and not just the child snatching, which is what the agency had a reputation for.
Uh-huh.
So I did a whole rebranding, and it helped a great deal in being able to communicate a positive message about children's services and not only that negative one.
Make the comparison for me between working in the public sector versus the private one.
It would be hard to return to the public sector. There are a lot of roadblocks to accomplishing what you want to accomplish. And I think unless you are close to the center of power where you get sort of that thrill, it's very hard as a creative person to be working in city government, or for me. That's just for me. I know that there are many, many creative people who are working for government, so I don't want to be offensive to them on any level. But for me, it would be hard, because what's nice about working for a private foundation is having some flexibility. And also part of our brand identity is to be risk-taking and experimental and to try new things. And I really love that.
It must be kind of stunning to meet some of the big heavy hitters that you do at the Ford Foundation. Drop a few names.
Oh, I can't drop a few names. But
Is that because it's a secret?
No, it's not because it's a secret. It's just, I don't know. I feel that that's not within the spirit of—
That's a good point.
—of our
work.
Well,
I'm just being gossipy and whatever. Because you do run conferences and meetings and you get more than bold-faced names to come in.
Well, everyone teases me because we had a big 50th anniversary event in Latin America, because we have three offices in Latin America, all of which marked their 50th anniversary this past year. And Gael Garcia Bernal, the actor, has a very wonderful foundation of his own called Ambulante, which brings social justice documentaries throughout Mexico. So he's been out at a lot of our events, and I've had some meetings
with— We're buds.
And then there are some social justice luminaries who probably are not household names, but who I feel are really special people that I've had the privilege to meet. And I have to say that one of the best things about moving to the foundation is I work – my boss and my co-director are just fantastic people. They're so good at what they do. I learn from them every day. And I think that's the greatest privilege for me because as you get older, a lot of people don't have mentors anymore. You don't have people that you're learning from. And this is such a wonderful part of my job now. I've had really amazing mentors and people who weren't just mentors and sort of giving advice, mentors who were able to edit my copy to shreds, you know, people that said, this isn't working, that isn't working, but never made me feel that I was at risk for not continuing my job. They believed in me and they just kept going and saying, I'm just going to keep telling you what needs to be improved. And that constant feedback, you know, it's almost like parenting. When you're raising children, when you're a kid, you're getting constant feedback. And that's what I got from my mentors as a professional.
Yes, but you can get constant feedback that's non-productive.
Yes.
Why did you do it this way? I can't believe you did it this way. You know, there's an art to that.
Yes.
Just like there is an art to parenting.
Yes, exactly. And I feel that I got really good mentoring. And I hope, and maybe my staff won't agree with this, but I hope that I give that kind of mentoring also.
This just dawned on me. Is there a difference between male and female mentors? And did you have enough women in your life to kind of guide you along?
I had both. I had male and female.
Well, certainly with Nick Scapetta at, you know, ACS, but
yes,
also along the way here. And in publishing, there tend to be more women than
exactly.
men.
Exactly.
And is there a sisterhood in publishing?
There can be, and then there cannot be.
Right.
There can
and
be
did
a
you
lot
experience
of,
both?
I have experienced both. And I'm always shocked when I see women not being kind to each other. It always shocks me. And then I have to remember, oh, that's sometimes how it is.
Do you get the progression of your professional life? Is this kind of an interesting thing to you that you've basically worked your way to wind up here? Or am I putting words in your mouth? Does it all make sense to you that now you've kind of reached the top?
It does make sense. It does make sense. But I'm a searcher. You know, I'll always be searching for – I don't think there's a top for me is what I'm saying. There's a continuation. And – but I always want to be learning. I always want to work with people who are pushing me and I'm pushing them. That's the fun part.
That's great. Leonora, thanks so much for coming by.
Absolutely.
Thank you for joining us for another edition of the 51% Conversations with Creative Women. I'm Sandy Klein.